From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, in with a new marijuana regulatory agency and out with the old licensing board.
The current board is basically punishing people who've been involved in the business.
He was the independent voice in the state's Flint water crisis investigation. But after speaking on Stateside and sharing concerns about potential fraud, Noah Hall was told he was no longer needed.
Telling the people of Flint that they are now represented by the attorneys for former Governor Snyder and the Department of Environmental Quality is a slap in the face. There's no other way to look at it.
And how Michigan's Democratic Party got its first Anishinaabeg caucus. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, last month, Attorney General Dana Nessel fired the independent special assistant attorney general who is investigating government wrongdoing in the Flint water crisis. Nessel opted to move the investigation back into the AG's office. The attorney she let go has some concerns.
Telling the people of Flint that they are now represented by the attorneys for former Governor Snyder and the Department of Environmental Quality is a slap in the face. There's no other way to look at it.
We will talk with Noah Hall later in the hour. But first, Governor Whitmer wants to overhaul the way marijuana is licensed in Michigan. Late last week, she signed an executive order getting rid of the volunteer board that considers license applications for medical marijuana businesses. In its place will be the Marijuana Regulatory Agency. It'll be contained with the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, known as LARA. The new agency will approve licenses for both the medical and recreational marijuana businesses, and according to Governor Whitmer, will be more streamlined, more efficient. Here with us now is Matt Abel, an attorney with Cannabis Counsel. It's a law firm centered around cannabis cases and cannabis clients, from patients to caregivers, dispensaries, and many other marijuana businesses. It is good to see you here. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Cynthia. Thank you for having me.
So how do you feel about this move by the governor?
I'm very excited about this. The board has been one of the biggest holdups in proceeding to license facilities. People have been waiting for people's terms to end and for more liberal replacements to be appointed. This is an end run around that.
How do you see the Marijuana Regulatory Agency acting differently and operating differently from this board that was appointed in the spring of 2017?
Well, under the executive order from the governor, the board will be abolished, and the agency will issue the licenses. And we see that as a net gain. The board is taking any excuse to deny licenses, and in fact, the people who are most subject to being denied are people who have been historically involved in the cannabis businesses in the past. So the current board is basically punishing people who've been involved in the business. And I think that's a bad idea. If we're trying to move to a regulated system and we're trying to eliminate the black market, we're much better off by bringing those people into the taxation and regulation system rather than pushing them away. If we push them away and they intend to stay in the business, they'll stay in the black market.
And what has that meant for medical marijuana patients in Michigan and caregivers?
Well, the slowness of the rollout of the dispensaries has been terrible for patients. Previously, we had hundreds of dispensaries in Michigan, but once the board was established over a year ago, they began to put forth proposals to close various dispensaries. And people who've been following it see that the temporary operators have been extended and extended again, not by design, but because of all of the pushback from patients who otherwise have no access to medicine.
So how do you expect things to be different under this new marijuana regulatory agency?
I think the agency has the opportunity to speed things up. What we have seen is, in the past, at each board meeting, there have been maybe 40 or 50 facilities licenses up for consideration. At the February meeting, there were around 100 that were up. And so we've already seen some speed up in the process. The governor, the previous governor, Snyder, had the charge to appoint a board of no more than 3 members of any one political party. And what Governor Snyder did was he appointed 3 Republicans and 2 independents. So he appointed the most conservative board that he possibly could. 2 of the members are former law enforcement officers, and they're just not being fair about it.
Critics are worrying that now that it's going to be streamlined, this agency is going to license medical and recreational marijuana businesses. They're worried it's going to remove oversight. Is there validity to that concern?
I don't think so. There is plenty of oversight. In fact, we have a seed-to-sale tracking system under the Medical Marijuana Act, and LARA will have that information in real time. I think there's very little opportunity to go around this. I've had people ask me about different ways they might beat the system, so to speak. And first of all, I don't see any way to do that. But secondly, even if you did, it would be so difficult. It's easier just to comply and run a legitimate business.
I'm speaking with Matt Abel, who's an attorney with Cannabis Council, as we talk about Governor Whitmer's executive order that gets rid of the volunteer board that has been considering license applications for medical marijuana businesses and replacing it with the Marijuana Regulatory Agency. So from this licensing and regulation standpoint, what do you see it'll take to have recreational marijuana businesses up and running? And I think people want to know how long before we see shops selling recreational weed.
Well, Proposal 1, the language says that the license applications will be available no later than 1 year after the law took effect. That date was December 6th, and so the date at which applications must be available will be December 6th of this year. Now, that's not a beginning date. That's a drop-dead date. And so the applications certainly could be available sooner. It could be done very quickly without a lot of revisions. The other thing that's important to keep in mind is that the tax, the current 3% tax on medical marijuana, goes away, in a couple of days. And so the state will not receive anything other than the 6% sales tax. As soon as we license the adult use or recreational facilities, there's a 10% tax that will apply. And so it will be a revenue generation method. And the sooner that happens, the more receipts there will be.
Matt, since voters said yes to recreational marijuana last November, at last count, 295 cities and towns voted not to allow recreational pot businesses. I checked the latest list from LARA last night, and it was up to 295. And we know the law allows communities to opt out. We spoke with Scott Greenlee of Healthy and Productive Michigan, which led the unsuccessful campaign against the recreational pot measure. And he said opting out is exactly what they've been working for. Let's take a listen.
We absolutely expect within probably 3 to 4 years, 70 to 80% of this state will have closed its doors to recreational marijuana outlets and things along those lines. We also want to make sure that we're working with policymakers, with pro-cannabis folks to the degree that we can as well, to make sure that there's as much oversight and as much enforcement as possible.
Is there common ground to work with groups like Healthy and Productive Michigan?
Not necessarily. I think Scott Greenlee is a prohibitionist. And first of all, you should take anything he says with a grain of salt. And he certainly is not someone who promotes access for adults or use by adults. There are 1,773 municipalities in Michigan. So the fact that less than 300 of them have opted out is not all that scary. In fact, one of the things that we wrote into the MRTMA, the Michigan Regulation and Taxation of Marijuana Act, is the ability for citizen initiatives, petitions in every municipality. Generally, those are only available in cities and places that have it written into their charters. Specifically, general law townships do not have the right of initiative, except that it was written into this law. And so even in rural townships, there's the opportunity to get signatures of 5% of the number of people who voted for governor and put it on the ballot and put it up for a vote. What we see is still basically old white men running city councils and township boards who are way behind the citizens and the voters in this. And so to give the voters the opportunity, we've seen some cities opt out where the voters supported it. And I think that's contrary to public to good public policy. And so we would encourage people to organize and to put measures on the ballot. There are municipal elections in many cities this year. Next year, there will be many more local elections. And so we'll see how this plays out.
What about in Colorado? Some 75% of communities have opted out.
Well, it still isn't that difficult to find a place where you can obtain medical marijuana. And there's a good reason for communities not to opt out, and that is that the tax revenue is only going to flow to municipalities which have retail stores. If they want the money, they'll allow the sales.
We saw voters say yes to recreational marijuana, 56% to 44%. And then when we look at this nearly 300 communities saying we don't want pot businesses in our town, is this some NIMBY, not in my backyard? Like, I want legal weed, but not around me?
Well, partly. I mean, it may be that citizens are okay with not punishing people for it not being a crime, but that does not necessarily mean that they want it sold in their community. However, if you look at the statistics about this, the communities which have access, not just have legalization, but have access by stores, have lower incidences of domestic violence, of driving under the influence, of deaths by opiates. And so while marijuana may or may not be safe by itself, it certainly is a substitute for other less safe alternatives.
Do you think that there will come a day when pot is everyday stuff and there will not be a need for attorneys like you who specialize in cannabis cases?
I certainly hope so, but frankly, I expect to be retired by the time that happens.
Matt Abel is with Cannabis Council. Matt, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Cynthia.
Coming up, a brand new caucus in the Michigan Democratic Party is ready and eager to bring Native American issues to the political forefront.
I would love to work on different issues that have been bothering us. We got the missing and murdered Indigenous women. There's Line 5 still. We got the highest prison rates, highest domestic violence rates, lowest graduation rates, mental health issues.
In 10 minutes, we talk with one of the founders of the Anishinaabeg Caucus. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Amazon's recent announcement it's backing out of its plans to set up a new headquarters in New York City prompted plenty of conversations about whether it is wise for cities to offer up all those tax incentives, all those goodies, in hopes of luring a big prize like Amazon and its 25,000 jobs. There's something else to consider, just what happened when colleges and universities reshaped themselves to suit the needs of a mega corporation such as Amazon. Jason Owen Smith is a sociology professor and executive director of IRIS, the Institute for Research on Innovation and Science at the University of Michigan. Good to have you here. So you wrote a piece in The Conversation exploring, and I'm quoting here, the perils of partnerships between higher education and business. How did you see that play out in this failed Amazon deal with New York City?
Well, I think Amazon offers a really visible case that points to some of the dangers. It also points to some of the possibilities. So I'm not someone who would argue that there shouldn't be partnerships between business and universities. I think it can be an important part of a university's mission. What the Amazon case shows us is the potential dangers of having universities link their work, particularly their teaching and research, too closely in too small a number of fields to the needs of a particular business or industry. I think the strength of universities, especially big research universities like the University of Michigan, is precisely in their diversity of activities and in the ability that gives them to connect with lots of different, sometimes conflicting stakeholders and constituencies, and they put that at risk when they narrow themselves or focus too closely on a single partnership.
And are you aware, did we see this happening? Let's start with New York, where, you know, oh, they're coming. There was the big announcement. Did we see some schools and universities around the New York area start to go, oh, we need to change, we need to modify?
I think we saw some of that in both New York and in Virginia.
Because we know they're also going to be in Arlington. So
right,
what are we seeing? What kind of course and what kind of reaction from schools?
Well, so there are a couple of things. And again, these aren't bad on their face, but they raise questions for us about what a university should be and should do. So in Virginia, for instance, the state is putting a lot of new money into what a memo from UVA called Amazon-related fields.
Right? Such as
business, computer science, electrical engineering. Virginia Tech is opening a new $1 billion innovation campus just a few minutes from where the new Amazon headquarters will be. And that's going to focus exclusively on these fields and on particular areas like cybersecurity that are of real interest to Amazon. Which, again, is not a bad thing, unless in a time when budgets are stretched and states are disinvesting in their public university, it comes at the cost of some of the other stuff.
Yeah. And I know that's not just unique to Amazon, because in your piece for The Conversation, you tell the story of the University of California Berkeley's attempts to partner up with the big Swiss pharma company Novartis and with BP, the huge oil company. What happened there?
They're both famous instances where in trying to forge a partnership with a big company to do some shared research in both of these cases, the goal at Berkeley was to create research institutes that were joint with the company focused on agricultural biotechnology in the Novartis case and on environment, sustainability, and oil in the BP case. Both of those caused real concerns on campus about the autonomy of research, about the career directions of students who worked in these things. And they also point to one of the same things that the Amazon case in New York points to, the challenges of putting your eggs very significantly in a single basket with a company whose situation is going to change. So agricultural biotechnology went south. Novartis spun out the part of its company that was doing that. And as a result, you know, Berkeley's investment kind of was left hanging.
Okay.
At BP, oil prices went south. BP took its option to stop paying into the $100 million fund that it was going to. Berkeley was left hanging. That didn't happen in New York, obviously, because there wasn't enough time.
Yeah.
But one of the challenges here is that universities benefit from stability. And when they wed themselves to the business cycle very tightly, that makes things harder.
This raises questions, I guess, about what should be the true role of a university. And I think to those of us on the outside of the university, well, we kind of would say, well, gee, isn't the whole point of universities turn out graduates who can land jobs and meet the needs of a region's employers? Or are we missing something with that point of view?
The short answer is yes, they should do that. But that's not all they should do. So I just wrote a book. It's called Research Universities and the Public Good. And one of the things I argue is that we as a society make huge public investments in universities, in a relatively small number of very big, very expensive, very diverse universities that are large, that educate the plurality of students, and that do the vast majority of federally funded research. Now, we do that for all kinds of reasons, most notably to sort of push forward the frontiers of human knowledge. But I think that the thing that we don't pay enough attention to is the idea that what these institutions represent is a kind of insurance against an uncertain future. So these universities, we invest in them, and they create conditions by developing new knowledge in lots of fields, by keeping it as open and publicly available as possible, by training people across all kinds of range of things, and by helping those people find jobs and later careers outside all over society, universities position themselves to be uniquely able to identify problems we don't know we have yet and to respond to them and to generate opportunities that we would have been hard-pressed to articulate. And so if we think about investing in universities and academic science and education, both in the short term with the goal of helping every student get the kind of job they want and having the kind of life they want. As a professor, that's very important to me, but also in terms of thinking about how we create a social infrastructure that lets our society be more resilient in the face of a volatile future. That's when it becomes really important, I believe, to attend to the diversity of the types of knowledge work a university does, to its stability, to its ability to connect to lots of different parts of society rather than making it sort of focused on a single constituency.
Do you worry where that flexibility and that sense of being able to respond to future challenges, is that being lost with this real intense focus on STEM?
I think it is. Again, I would never argue that we shouldn't teach STEM and engineering. I think it's essential and really important. I've spent a career studying how it's important. I think we too often forget that STEM is a part of the liberal arts, right? When people say liberal arts, I think the common thought is that that's just sort of the squishy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a sociologist. I fall right in
archaeology,
that.
Archaeology, museum science. Yeah.
Right. But
yeah,
the classical liberal arts also includes STEM. And so I think we want to teach that. We want to make sure that we are developing the knowledge and the workforce that can let us do this work. But what we miss is that being able to connect to lots of different groups in society, some of them you come to the university through non-STEM routes. So we don't want to skimp on social work and urban planning and the arts and culture, because that's part of creating and sustaining a vibrant regional and national community. And it's also the case that some of the areas where universities can make connections because of this non-STEM knowledge are precisely the places where we might expect to see the problems that we want to be able to respond to. So part of the challenge is making sure not just that the universities are teaching and doing research in all these areas, but that inside the universities there are mechanisms for the areas to talk to each other. So creating even internally a big sense of haves and have-nots could be dangerous to this larger social insurance mission.
If you're running a university or institute of higher education and you look around and you see that mad scramble to land Amazon or in Wisconsin to land Foxconn, what's the moral of that story?
For me, the moral of the story is go ahead. You know, work with your local community and elected leaders to try to do that. But think about what uniquely an institution like your university can bring to the table. I would like to think that if New York universities, for instance, had reached out through their various channels to activist communities and to others, they could have provided a setting where Amazon and representatives of the city could have legitimately sat down and hashed out differences, and the result might have been a stronger regional engagement. And so absolutely, every university should be concerned about doing the very best it can by its students and about trying to make sure that its partners and communities benefit from its work. But we should take a long view and think about all of the ways that universities can make that happen rather than jumping to what's immediately visible right now.
Jason Owen Smith, sociology professor and executive director of the Institute for Research on Innovation and Science at the University of Michigan. You will find his piece on the Amazon pullout from New York City and the perils of partnerships between higher ed and business at theconversation.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much. That was fun.
If you look around and realize that you don't have a seat at the table, well, build your chair and pull it up to that table. And that's pretty much what a group of Native Americans did with the Michigan Democratic Party. They got together and created the Anishinaabeg Caucus. Andrea Pierce is one of the founders of the caucus. She is a member of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Andrea, good to have you back with us on Stateside.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
So what gave you and the other co-founders the idea to found the caucus? What was missing when you looked around at the Michigan Democratic Party?
We were missing, the Native American people. What had originally happened was that I had went to my very first convention was when I went as Team Dana. I was all excited for Dana Nessel. And I went as a precinct delegate the first time I ever won.
For the Michigan, so you were at the Michigan Democratic mm-hmm. Party State Convention.
Right, as a precinct delegate, and I was all excited, and all these candidates were coming in the room. You're so important, you're so important, I want your endorsement. How can I get you to vote for me? And asking questions back and forth, and I'm sitting there looking at the list of caucuses because I had never been before. And I went as a Progressive Caucus member, and I was looking for the Native American Caucus or American Indian,
anything,
Indigenous.
Anything. Yeah.
And I didn't see that. I saw a whole list of different.
Who'd you see?
I saw the Black Caucus, the Hispanic Caucus, the LGBTQA Disability Caucus, the Yemeni, the Arabic. I did not see anything remotely considered Native American.
So you thought to yourself,
where are we? Oh, my goodness. How are we missing this? And at the time, I was texting my friend Desmond Berry, who's now the vice chair of the caucus. We're not here. We're not here. I don't see anybody I know. And I was really, really surprised. I said, okay, this can't be. Maybe we just didn't come this time. That's possible. So I waited till after the elections because everything was so fired up and ramped up and we were just busy. And after the elections, I started asking people, okay, where's my caucus at? I want to join my people. I want to be with them too. What's going on? And Michelle Dietrich, she checked and couldn't find us.
And who's that?
She's part of the Michigan Democratic Party also. She's a very good friend of mine. She's helped me out a lot. I've had so much support.
So everybody looked around and realized, oh my gosh, Andrea's right.
Yeah, we're not here. And originally they wanted me to, or I was being asked to join the Environmental Caucus. And I was like, well, that would have been fine, but now I know we're not here. We have a lot of our own issues that we need to take care of, not just the environment.
So who did you pull together in this effort? Who's with you?
The board members is, I asked, Desmond Berry is a very good friend of mine. He's with the Grand Traverse Band of Odawa and Chippewa Indians. Mm-hmm. He's with the DNR up there and does a lot of work with Line 5 and very, very wonderful person. And then I asked Julie Dye, who's working with the mascot issue, the Redskins, and she goes to different school boards and talks about that. And she's our secretary, and she's just amazing.
And then Tom Showman?
Tom Showman, he brings, 8 years on tribal council with Grand Traverse Band of Odawa and Chippewa Indians, and he's just amazing. It's just an amazing group of people that as soon as I said, hey, we don't have this, we're missing. And they're like, oh, my gosh, we need to do it.
And these are busy people, but realize that you needed to have a seat at that Michigan Democratic Party table.
Yes.
For people that, you hear of conventions and you hear that word caucus, and that, what does a caucus group do within a state political party?
Well, now, beware that I am still learning. I've only been to a couple of conventions.
What do you want your caucus to do? Let's put it that way.
I would love to be able to get Native candidates running for different chairs or different positions in the government. That would be wonderful. I would love to work on different issues that have been bothering us. We got the missing and murdered Indigenous women. There's Line 5 still. We got the highest prison rates, highest domestic violence rates, lowest graduation rates, mental health issues. I would like to work on some of those and the mascot issue also.
Because that you've already gotten busy, right?
Yes.
So tell us about what you did.
We came out making a loud noise. We had got the resolution, and it's condemning the use of the term Redskins, passed at the Democratic Convention, unanimously approved by over 3,000 people. I was so amazed when that just went through.
The national convention, right?
Michigan State.
Michigan, over 3,000, mm-hmm. So at the state convention.
Yes, it was amazing.
As you look around, are there states, Andrea Pierce, with Native American caucuses that have been doing this where you could look and say, look what they're doing there, we want to do that here?
I'm just finding those out. And I found out there are other states that do have them. There's the National Native American Caucus, and so there are out there. It's just not in this state.
If you just join me, I am talking with Andrea Pierce, who is one of the founders of the Anishinaabeg Caucus of the Michigan Democratic Party. She's a member of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, and they are looking to get the Native American community of Michigan at the seat, really at the table of the Michigan Democratic Party. You know, for everyone listening, to get everybody on the same page, explain that word, Anishinaabeg.
Anishinaabeg, okay. There's 12 tribes in Michigan, and we consider ourselves the original people of these lands here, the occupied territories of Michigan. And that's us, the Anishinaabeg. We're the original people.
And so I'm interested then, are people who are not Native American, can they, who care about issues that are important to the community? Can they be part of the caucus?
Oh, they sure can. Everybody is welcome to join. You have to be Anishinaabeg enrolled in one of the 12 tribes to be on the board. But other than that, everybody can join. We want people to come. We haven't been here. We want everybody.
What do you hope that this caucus, the Anishinaabeg caucus, will mean for all Michiganders in years to come?
I'm hoping this will be a chance for us to empower our people. We have a lot of activists that are always out there working towards, you know, these same causes that I've been and issues that I've been mentioning. And to me, it seems like it goes so far and then it just either plateaus out or just dies down and then we don't get any results.
You want to move it over the finish line.
I really do. I'd like to see if we can get some these issues tackled and off of our plate and work on other issues that are coming up also.
Well, it has to. If there has to be kind of a feeling, you really can't quantify what it probably feels like to say that you're part of solutions of problems instead of just saying somebody should do something.
Yeah. That's the difficult part, because it's always easy to say, oh, someone should go do it, and, you know, point your finger, how come that's not being done? But it's harder to pull up your bootstraps and say, okay, we're not here and we need to be here.
Well, once again, I guess it seems like the invitation is out to all members of the Anishinaabeg community in Michigan, mm-hmm. and also people who support them and who are interested in the issues they're in, to join the Anishinaabeg Caucus of the Michigan Democratic Party. And I've been talking with one of the co-founders and a board member, Andrea Pierce, a member of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, Noah Hall was recently let go by Attorney General Dana Nessel from his role as an independent special assistant prosecutor in the Flint water crisis investigation. The AJ's move to bring the investigation in-house raises some red flags for him. I will talk with Noah Hall after the break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We return now to the Attorney General's ongoing Flint water investigation. Back on January 7th, Noah Hall, who was then a special assistant attorney general for the Flint water investigations, made some explosive allegations right here on Stateside. He said the process of approving the Karenandi Water Authority's pipeline project was, in his words, riddled with fraud. Remember now, the KWA was the reason state officials switched Flint's drinking water to the Flint River, a move that was supposed to be temporary until that new KWA pipeline was built. Well, the switch is what led to the untreated river water corroding old pipes and causing lead to leach into the city's drinking water. Here is Noah Hall from January 7th.
The state of Michigan committed a fraud in indebting the city of Flint for bonds for a project that it was never going to see. Folks in Flint are going to be paying debt on bonds that an emergency manager saddled them with, thanks to the involvement of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the State Attorney General's office. We need to get to the bottom of this. We need to see how this happened. We need to see why the Attorney General's office did not provide independent oversight of the Department of Environmental Quality in issuing the administrative consent order, and we need to ensure that far better accountability put in place in the future so that this type of fraud doesn't happen again.
Well, a month after that interview aired, Attorney General Dana Nessel fired Noah Hall. The reason, apparently, the comments he made on this show. Noah Hall is back with us again. Noah, welcome back. So what exactly did the Attorney General's office say when they fired you?
Well, that's a difficult question for me to answer because I have to respect the Attorney General's office as my former client. So anything that the Attorney General's office shares with me as their client, even in the course of terminating me as their attorney, is closely protected with confidentiality.
So what can you say as far as your understanding of why you were let go?
Well, I could share what I've what's public, and I think that's the safest ground to stay on. Publicly, the Attorney General's office has made a policy decision to essentially close the independent investigation and turn the work of investigating, prosecuting, and litigating fraud in Flint over to the state's attorneys housed in the State Attorney General's office.
So we don't need you anymore.
Well, it's not that they don't need me anymore. I think they're saying to take the personal edge off of it. They don't need an independent counsel anymore. The Attorney General has made a policy decision that she thinks the interests of the folks in Flint, especially their interests adverse to the state of Michigan, can be represented by the state attorney general's office. She believes that the state attorney general's office can essentially wear both hats, represent the people who are affected, as well as the governor and the state agencies and the other folks who are responsible.
When you were on here on January 7th, you talked about the attorney general's office signing of that administrative consent order in 2014, issuing bonds to build the Carinati Water Authority, and you described that as loaded with fraud. Can you offer any more details about exactly what kind of fraud you think was buried in all of that?
Sure. And I could speak to this pretty comfortably because it's public, and a lot of the allegations have been made public both in criminal charges as well as in civil complaints in both state and federal court. The heart of it is this. In the rush to come up with $80 million to build this Karangangi Water Authority pipeline, the emergency manager and the state of Michigan through its Department of Environmental Quality and the Attorney General's office essentially came up with a fraudulent project to justify the bonding of $80 million. That fraudulent project was the cleanup of a lime sludge lagoon. It was the basis of an administrative consent order. And the administrative consent order should have never been issued. It should have never been the basis for the bonds. The bonds are not, were certainly not necessary to address the underlying sludge problem. It was a scheme. It was a fraud. It was a shell game. And the State Department of Environmental Quality was at the center of it. But the Attorney General's office, as the attorneys for the state of Michigan, as well as the attorneys for the Department of Environmental Quality, have a formal role in approving administrative consent orders to ensure that they're legitimate. And that didn't happen here. It was just another failing and another instance of another part of state government not doing its job for the people of Flint.
Why? What was the driver behind this, finding this sludge project? What was the driver behind all of this, do you think?
Well, the Michigan Civil Rights Commission found that the driver for the KWA pipeline has a lot to do with, unfortunately, the decades-old stories of racism and division between our cities and suburbs, the desires for to break up the Detroit Water and Sewer District, and the legitimate concerns of folks in the northern suburbs wanting their own water supply. I would say that overall, the KWA pipeline was a bad policy decision, but there was nothing inherently criminal or fraudulent about wanting a new pipeline. It's how they went about it. It's how they justified paying for it, and it was how they schemed to indebt the city of Flint to pay for it.
When you spoke on January 7th, you were addressing concerns you had that go to the Bill Schuette era, not the Dana Nessel era. She, in fact, just started working as the attorney general. Why do you think that she felt your services as independent counsel were no longer needed?
Well, that's a tough question. It's kind of like asking the guy who got dumped why you broke up. It's not probably a great question for me. I think it was something I said. As is the case when a working relationship is over, you're not entirely sure what the reason was. But I was assured that there was no concerns about my performance, quality of legal work, or anything like that, of course, and that it was a policy decision that the Attorney General's office did not want an independent special counsel looking into the activities of the state. And I think that I could discuss this part of it, I think, publicly, because the Attorney General's office has now stated publicly that the reason for ending the special counsel investigation is that they believe that the interests of Flint and the people of the state of Michigan can be represented by the same attorneys who represented Governor Snyder.
So with no more independent special counsel, are you confident the Attorney General's office can investigate itself and its own role in what happened in Flint and, more importantly, hold people to account?
No. I'm, I'm, I'm very concerned about the lack of independent investigation. I personally have no hard feelings over being terminated. I wasn't even taking pay for the past 2.5 years. So being terminated from an unpaid position isn't even really the same as being fired. It's probably more like being dumped. And while I'm eager to keep helping the folks in Flint, I absolutely understand and respect the decision of the Attorney General to use another attorney. That's well within her discretion. My concern is that instead of replacing me and my team with other independent attorneys, she's replaced me and my team with attorneys who are salaried by the state of Michigan, who are staffed in the Attorney General's office. And most problematically, these exact attorneys have been defending Governor Snyder, the Department of Environmental Quality, and numerous other arms of the state in cases against Flint residents. This is the legal team that has been defending the former governor against the people of Flint in both state and federal court. And now they're turning around and saying that the same legal team that has defended the governor can not only adequately represent the people of Flint, but will go a step further and investigate further wrongdoings in the state and the Attorney General's office. I don't see how that's possible.
I know the Detroit News kind of dug into this in a recent story and quoted some legal experts who said it is possible for an assistant attorney general to maintain both plaintiff and defendant roles in an ethical way. And should also be noted, an ethics officer in the AG's office is reviewing this situation.
Well, there's absolutely room in terms of the legal ethics for an attorney to have this dual role. First of all, whether it's the right thing to do is a different question from whether it's ethically permissible. But more fundamentally, without disclosing confidential information, I can assure you that the cases that we were developing on behalf of the people of the state would inherently create a conflict for any attorney defending the state, because many of our claims and our issues involve conspiracies and joint actions by state actors and private actors, by emergency managers and Department of Environmental Quality, by the Attorney General's office and the state treasurer. It's very difficult in the Flint water crisis to pick one or two responsible parties, say that you're going to go after them, side with the plaintiffs, and ignore all of the other responsible parties.
And call it a day.
Yeah, it's a very tortured way to go about investigating the Flint water crisis and bringing justice to the people of Michigan. What we really need, not just for Flint, is a truly independent voice for people who've been poisoned and wronged by their government. And folks who've been poisoned and wronged by their government should not have to call Lansing to go and investigate on their behalf.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Noah Hall, the former Special Assistant Attorney General for the state's Flint water investigation. He was removed from that post a month ago by Attorney General Dana Nessel. Are there other questions, other lines of inquiry that you were investigating that you are concerned will go unaddressed?
Yeah, without going into specifics or without violating any of my obligations as a former prosecutor, and based on my familiarity with the documents, absolutely, there are fundamental and very deep issues about accountability and about oversight and about responsiveness to public concerns that have not been addressed and that require an independent investigation. Most fundamentally, a lot of money has been spent in Flint on the KWA pipeline and now subsequently on much of the a lot of money has been spent on lawyers defending what the state did. If a fraction of those resources were used to investigate why the state did the wrongs that it committed, we'd have a much better chance at avoiding these problems in the future.
You know, you spoke with us, Noah, during the first week of Attorney General Nessel's tenure. Why did you choose to go public with your concerns rather than bring them to the new AG privately?
Oh, well, I have a tremendous amount of respect for the new Attorney General, and one of the early messages she sent was that she was going to be getting involved in the Flint water litigation on behalf of the state defendants in an effort to settle the case, which frankly I'm very supportive of. I think it's been horrendous that the state of Michigan has continued to defend itself against its own residents in the 3 years since the crisis has unfolded. So I was really excited that the new Attorney General wants to settle and give folks in Flint the justice they deserve. What that means is, as an ethical matter, that she is representing the state of Michigan, and I think doing so in a very good way. But I'm representing the people of the state, adverse to the State Department of Environmental Quality, adverse to the state government, and so it would not be appropriate for me to communicate directly with the Attorney General on the matter. Instead, after she was elected, I communicated directly with Attorney General's office as an opposing counsel to keep them apprised of all developments in the case, and I invited a dialogue with the state solicitor general, who would be directly supervising the prosecution.
What does this move, in your view, say to the people of Flint still looking for answers as to how their drinking water became poisoned by lead?
Well, the folks in Flint know how their drinking water got poisoned. They know it was by the state. And what they're looking for is some true accountability and justice from the state. And regardless of whether, as an ethical matter, the Attorney General can get away with this, it's not going to do anything to rebuild the trust and the faith in government from the people in Flint and really statewide. What folks in Flint want to see is true justice and accountability with an acknowledgement of the wrongs that were committed and tangible measures to make sure this will never happen again. Telling the people of Flint that they are now represented by the attorneys for former Governor Snyder and the Department of Environmental Quality is a slap in the face. There's no other way to look at it. The folks in Flint have now been wronged yet again, and once more, the state is telling them that they don't have an independent voice, that they don't have any legitimate concerns that the state can't address, and essentially leave this to the state and its professionals to take care of. We're 3 years after the water crisis began to unfold, 4 years after the water crisis unfolded, and former Governor Snyder has racked up millions in private outside counsel paid for by the people of the state of Michigan. Other state officials have racked up millions of dollars of private outside counsel to defend their interests against the people of the state. I didn't take any money from the state for the past 2.5 years trying to be an independent voice for the people of Flint and for the wrongs that were committed. And it is frustrating to me that in all of the changes that are being made to bring justice in the Flint water crisis, the first major change is getting rid of the unpaid independent special counsel instead of some of the other really striking injustices going on.
Noah Hall, the former independent special counsel in the Flint water investigation, also an environmental law professor at Wayne State Law School. Thank you so much for being with us, Noah.
Thank you.
And we reached out to the Department of Environmental Quality. A spokesman said the department has no comment at this time. And we reached out to Attorney General Dana Nessel's office. Spokesman Dan Olson sent us this response, and I quote, "Our office adheres to the highest ethical standards, which is why we asked our ethics officer for a complete and thorough ethical review of how he brought the civil case against Veolia and other Flint water consultants back into the department. That report showed no ethical concerns. We also specifically asked if the AG plans to investigate the Office of Attorney General's role in issuing bonds for the KWA pipeline. Olson replied, and again I quote, investigations remain under the purview of the criminal side of the conflict wall, and civil attorneys do not have any authority over those investigations. Tomorrow on Stateside, well, you know it is Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras. Punchki Day, and you are bound to see and taste the fried dough glazed and filled with fruit and cream. The Polish dessert has dominated the culinary landscape in Michigan for years, which has led to some interesting takes on this pastry. We'll talk with a bar owner in Hamtramck who created the Punchki Bomb, a fat little fried treat that features booze. That's tomorrow on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, Rozzy Joffrey, and Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.